Welcome back to Punches and Popcorn, a show where we slice our way through the best, the worst, the history, and the science behind martial arts movies and the heroes that made them. You are joining us tonight in our inaugural season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s. For the first time in our show's history, we are curating a collection of episodes in a season format, this time focusing on some of our favorite martial arts motion pictures from the decade we grew up in, the 1980s. I am your host, Michael Huntone, and with me as always is our resident genius, Jason No Surrender Bills.
Not to open my diary, but this movie was a big deal. This first time I actually met Dom, we actually watched this in an actual physical movie theater, and Mike was there, and we had a good time. So I'm very excited we're finally talking about this, because this movie left an impression on all three of us. So let's do this.
Oh, yes. The memory road that we are going to walk down tonight will not just be to the 80s in this movie, but a really, I think, formative experience for us on this show. So we also have, of course, the third in our trio, our walking weapon, the professor, Dr. Ding Dongs Demore.
Yeah, I feel like this, well, first of four movies was really where we gelled as a podcast. I remember, and I also remember I think the only thing we had was caffeinated drinks and popcorn for 8 hours straight.
Yes.
That was, yeah. So, audience, if you're wondering, it was the, what's the name of the theater in Syracuse we saw this?
The Palace.
The Palace, yes. It was four movies, right?
Yes, yep. It was. And it started like 6 p.m.
Yeah, and we got out real late, and it was something. It was a marathon of some pretty interesting movies. And this one, I mean, I feel like Revenge of the Ninja was my favorite one out of all four, but this one was something.
Oh,
I'll never forgot it. Never forgot it.
Oh, yeah. And this is actually, now this is the third movie from that quadrilogy that we've covered. The first one we covered was the last movie that night, Dirty Ho. We also covered the, as Dom mentioned, Revenge of the Ninja, did that with our friends Chris Pajali and Grady Hendrix last Ninja November. And now this, the only one we haven't done yet is Chinese Hercules, that I feel like we've got to do at some point because it stars the man that was the patron saint of our show. We started
still is.
Yeah, he still is. But we haven't gotten him in a movie recently. And the man we're talking about, of course, is Bolo Young. Anyways, Bolo was not in this movie. And the movie we are talking about tonight is 1986's No Retreat, No Surrender. This film, whose name was taken from a Bruce Springsteen song, legit, would be legendary director Corey Ewan's answer to Karate Kid, as our friends Chris Pajali and Grady Hendrix explained it to us at that very same martial arts movie festival. In this familiar tale, or rather a collection of familiar tales, we get a young karate-obsessed quote-unquote teen forced to move to a new town and face bullies, foreign and domestic, in a wild romp that would include breakdancing, cake-eating, grave-visiting, arguably the most egregious act of Bruceploitation ever, and introduce the world to a certain Belgian martial artist who would soon go on to take over the martial arts movie world. And if you've listened to our show, you know this same martial artist would take over our hearts too. But before we dive into this 80s martial arts classic, we need to begin with the razor-sharp brilliance of our genius, who will help us cut into the world of this film with our own gospel, the gospel of the guillotine.
You got it, genius.
Genius.
I'm a genius.
He's geniusy.
Wile E. Coyote. Super genius.
Was it you, genius?
You little genius, you.
Being a genius certainly has its advantages.
Alrighty, so I quickly want to do some table setting here in terms of like production companies. So we've talked about Golden Harvest. We've obviously talked about Shaw Brothers at this point. This is a third Hong Kong production house, Seasonal Film Corporation. It's sort of tied into what we've talked about before, though, because the man who created it is Ng Sing Yoon. He worked in Shaw Brothers Studios. He actually, his first kind of job, quote unquote, on on the lot was working on as an assistant director on Chinese Boxer. He eventually sort of got more into like a suit producer role and eventually just got fed up, I think like mid early 70s with like Mona Fong and Run Run Shaw and all that stuff. Again, which we've talked about and discussed in the past, kind of her notorious reign in the studio. So he branched out and started his own production company, much like Golden Harvest. And they kind of had, you know, like an independent, you know, film studio. They didn't have like the budget of the Shaw studio. They didn't have the kind of young, exciting talent that Golden Harvest had, but they made a niche for themselves. Eventually, they did a movie we have discussed, Drunken Master, with Jackie Chan, and our Drunken episode, a favorite of mine. And what's great about it is that they kind of, because they were sort of new and a little ragtag, they would let Jackie Chan do you know, a quote-unquote comedy with Drunken Master. They also did Snake and Eagle Shadow with Jackie Chan. They had some other successes. Why this is interesting is this is their sort of like stab at doing like an American, like they're like, oh, we need to tackle the American box office. Like there's money over there. We're going to make it. And so this is what we get, and we're luckier for it. So I kind of just wanted to set the table in terms of like, we've talked about the studio before with Drunken Master, but also like they're definitely like Seasonal Film Corporation. I don't think I've ever even knew that name, but like they're right there kind of like boxing it out with Shaw Brothers and Golden Harvest in the like late 70s into early 80s. So it's kind of interesting. And that is the gospel this week.
Yeah, that's a great intro. I think it's important to tie seasonal films in here, but just some important connections to the stuff we've talked about and that are really important in the martial arts world and the movie world overall. Just a one thing I wanted to note where our American audiences will maybe be more familiar with Corey's work. And Dom, you definitely will. So he, aside from doing all these movies, he really gained a niche as an action martial arts fight choreographer in some films that I would think even our listeners that aren't as hardcore old school kung fu fans will know. He was the action coordinator for Man with the Iron Fists, a movie that hopefully someday we'll talk about. It'd be sweet if we talked about it with RZA, but again, a podcaster can dream. Was also, I believe, Jet Li's personal martial arts coordinator on The Expendables.
In Lethal Weapon 4, right?
Yep, Lethal Weapon 4 was his first big American one. He was the fight coordinator, I believe, for John Woo's Red Cliff 1 and 2, Bulletproof Monk, Cradle to the Grave, The One, Romeo Must Die. And what I was surprised by the most, he was the action coordinator, the martial arts coordinator for the first X-Men movie. Oh,
yes, wow. He was.
So yeah, really cool. Real cool connections here. And again, this is, you know, his first American film.
As far as I know, yes.
And as the cast that we'll talk about as we get into this movie here, for most of them, it was also their first film and nearly everybody in this movie. So I have blathered on now. It's time for us to get into No Retreat, No Surrender. So guys, just some initial thoughts in this movie.
Well, when I first saw it, it was a whole experience with you guys in the classic theater and yada, yada, yada. Looking at it with a more critical lens, I feel like this is, and I know we said this is Hong Kong's answer to Hong Kong Studios' answer to Karate Kid.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is Hong Kong's answer to an 80s teen movie. Like, yes. It is so derivative. It's insane. Yes. It is insanely derivative. And it's almost like you can tell that, like, they knew something about American culture, but they didn't know.
Yes, right. They didn't know everything.
They didn't really get it. It's like, it's the uncanny valley of 80s movies.
Oh,
because
well
it's
said.
It's not American, but it's
right.
Just not American enough. And you can kind of tell it's not American, and it's just,
but somehow that makes it better.
In a once again, we have our schlock apologist, the genius. Like it's schlocky because of it. It has like, I mean, so you know, good. There's a shoestring budget, which I'll let go. But like, first of all, the token black friend just hurts me watching that. Like I'm like, come on, he dresses like Michael Jackson. He moonwalks,
break dances.
He breakdances, he raps for the hell of it. I'm like, oh, come on. Like, that, there's that.
May I quickly just say, like, imagine watching this. And here's the thing. When I watch it, I get mad at myself because if I was, I don't know, like 11 and I saw this movie, this would be my favorite movie. Like, by far. I'm so mad that young Jason didn't know about this movie. Like, this is kind of, like, new to me. Like, I think I've heard the title, obviously, in the past, but I'm just so mad that I'm, like, in my 40s now, and I'm just experiencing this movie for the first time when you we all saw it together. Like,
right.
I failed as a child is what I'm trying to tell you.
You did not.
Yeah, I didn't. I had not seen it. I hadn't heard of it until maybe shortly before, I think, is when the physical release of this happened recently, like not long before we went to see this in the theater. There was a long time, I guess, that in like the 80s or 90s, this was a on HBO a lot movie, but I didn't have HBO as a kid, so I wasn't watching Jack on HBO.
I did, though, and I didn't know about this. Like, I failed. I'm telling you to.
But yeah, it wasn't on DVD at all until the Blu-ray came out. So it was kind of hidden for a while and just recently came out. And then, right, my introduction was...
Well, I wasn't finished. I wasn't finished with the tropes because there's a lot of them. Like, there's some tropes and there's some new thing. You know what it is? There's tropes from America and there's also tropes from Hong Kong. And the Hong Kong ones are more subtle. But I noticed them too. I wouldn't have noticed them if I watched this movie 3 years ago, but I noticed them now. So, so the American tropes, you got the kid who's bullied, who fights back. You got the pacifist who's like, oh, I do need to fight after all. That's a common theme you see in these movies. The high school, the girlfriend with the pushy boyfriend who really likes our hero. The overimportance of like your friends in high school, yada yada yada. So like there's the new town and the whole making new friends and fighting for your standing up against bullies and yada 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 and campy 80s music and music that sounds like a cat was crawling across a Casio keyboard, like the whole thing. But here's another thing I noticed. There's something so the director, he worked on Fist of Fury, which we covered. And one of the major things about Fist of Fury that you'll notice is it uses Bruce Lee as a vehicle for nationalism and talking about how China and Chinese culture, I don't want to say superior, but like, yeah, I'll say it is superior to Japanese. There are hints of this in there too. Because let's face it, so karate is a Japanese martial art. It's arguably super popular at this time. And what happens? The karate guys get their ass whooped by Jean-Claude Van Damme, who, by the way, is Russian from the bad guy place. And what happens? How does he win? By not doing karate, but doing Jeet Kune Do, which is from Hong Kong. Yeah. So that is a subtle, subtle jab at Japanese martial arts and it at the expense. This is a boost for Chinese martial arts at the expense of Japanese martial arts. Very, very subtly. I did notice it. I was like, well, yeah, I see that. Okay. All right. Yeah. So interesting. In that trope, like I said, we've seen that trope several times. So it's not exactly new. It's just sprinkled in there a little bit.
Dom needs to be called the genius. I like the title schlockologist. Like, I really like it. So I appreciate that. Mike, what are your thoughts like in terms of first exposure to this? Because this is our second time through for all of us. Like, were you as baffled as Dom and I?
You know, this movie is an onion. The overuse trope. There's so many layers to it and that you notice, like, that. Well, I don't want to spend too much time digging into some of those things because I'm sure we'll talk about it throughout, but there's new things. There's a lot of strings that don't necessarily get tied together here, and do we need them or two or not? I guess it depends on what you're looking for out of this movie. If you're looking for a credible story and a solid plot through the middle, this is not the film for you, my friend. There's so many layers and threads to this. Let's jump into the story and we can start to unpeel some of those layers. Because let's wind it back to the beginning. Our film begins, as so many other films, in Los Angeles, in the town of Sherman Oaks, in a karate dojo where we are introduced. So we're introduced to our hero, Jason, in the dojo with his dad. And we're also introduced to a trope that we're very familiar with, the organized crime group that is on a mission to take over all dojos.
From New York. Literally, like, how far away can we go? Let's go to LA.
Right. Is this inciting incident the most baffling yet? Like, what if, like, the Godfather, like the Corleone family is like, we gotta get in these dojos. That's where the money is. Like, what?
So I was baffled too. So why do they want the dojos? Is it because they want to use it Someone as a answer. Front? Or do they want to train like John Wick? No, like seriously, like how? Like what's the angle?
I want to know that. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
So in my mind, this exists in the same fictional America that the Karate Kid exists in that there is this time, allegedly in the 80s, where karate is the most important thing in America, and the entire social lives of teenagers depends on regional karate tournaments and the dojos they go to. And in that world, the dojo is the centerpiece of society. So that's the way that I read it. And I almost think, so Dom, we talked a little bit about it taking tropes from Hong Kong movies too, that I think if you look at it in there, some of the movies that we've talked about, like, oh man, one of my favorites, King Boxer, where that was kind of the whole plot of that too, right? Where there was these kung fu schools that, like, control of the school equated to control of
the town,
the society.
Yeah, and we asked that question. I remember I asked that question. I'm like, okay, what happens? Like, what happens?
Right. So I almost think it's like, it's that, again, where we talk, I love that uncanny valley term, that because it's almost here, right? That they've applied this Hong Kong kung fu film perspective where the martial arts school is the most important thing. So of course bad guys want to take this over, and it's a dojo wouldn't just be a bunch of nerds like hanging out. This would be the most important place in the world that we would bring the Russian in to intimidate everybody.
I got bad news for you. A dojo is just full of a bunch of nerds.
That is such a good reason, Mike, that I feel like you should be called the plot apologist, because that is, I'm sold. Like, okay, I'm back in now.
Well, either way, and again, there's going to be lots left to conjecture here, but right, we're introduced to the bad guys, and we're introduced to Jean-Claude Van Damme, and who, of course, we all love. We've covered several of his movies. We will continue to, I'm sure, cover our man, the Muscles from Brussels, until he has no more movies for us left to cover.
Mike, did you read, like, this is his second movie, and he was, like, in a casting call? Like, he was just, like, in a line, and that's how they plucked him?
He had something else before, but I think this is the first, like, really notable thing.
Right, absolutely.
That he did. Yeah. And, right, that's what the writer said in the commentary, that they basically sent him out to grab, like, a group of people.
Yeah,
there was like 100 people that showed
up
for the audition. He grabbed three of them.
And he was one of them.
Right, and one of them. Wow. And then he just ends up being like, out of this movie, the biggest star.
Yeah.
As we'll talk about, you know, the star of this movie, Kurt McKinney, this is his first film. He had been in Louisville before this, moved out with his friend, and just showed up like
another casting call. I'll just try to audition for this movie. It's not like they're like, oh, we need to get in the Kurt McKinney game. Like, there's just a lot of fresh faces. Most you don't ever see again, but Van Damme you certainly do.
And McKinney did have a decent career after this, not in martial arts, but he did a number of soap operas after him.
Yep.
After this, which sounded like from his experience on this film, was a lot easier and definitely a little gentle in his body. And, you know, he gets a little beat up, as does his dad in this initial scene, right? And we're introduced to kind of their conflicting philosophies, because in my opinion, giving Jason any sort of philosophy, at least not to spoil later in this movie, but pre-Ghost Bruce, I think giving him any philosophy is being very generous. But his dad gives the traditional, you know, karate is for defense only, I won't fight, and that doesn't stop Jean-Claude from giving him just some really classic kicks, right?
Yeah, I will say, watching this again, the best parts of the movie, I mean, you know, one of the questions is, why are we here? Like, that's one of the things. Not why are we here in a philosophical way, but why are we watching this movie? And I think that's one of the things about this movie is, like, the Karate Kid. Why were we there? Were we there to watch Ralph Macchio beat the piss out of people? Not really. Like, it was a teen drama. It's coming of age. It's all that crap. We weren't there for the exploitation aspect, for the visual, to be visually awed. This movie has so much filler like that, and it's done, well, not great. Let's just put it that way. With a slap together story and terrible acting and trope after trope after trope. So it's a bad teen American teen movie. What I'm saying is this, is with all this very poorly put together teen movie tropes, you have these snippets of pretty solid martial arts. Yeah. So I really wish we got more of that. Like, I really wish this movie would have been a better movie if they just went full tilt into Kung Fu Hong Kong style and just set it in America. But the fact is, they really tried to make it a teen movie, and that's where the movie fails. Because the Jean-Claude Van Damme scenes are hot. I thought they were great. Like, I mean, it's not perfect, but we've seen a lot of, like, Hong Kong martial arts movies. Some of them are amazing. Some of them aren't great. This one is one of the, those fight scenes are on the better end of that. So yeah, I really it's a shame that they really tried to lean into something that wasn't their strength when they should have just had more ass kicking. It would have been a better movie.
Well, because then you have to do stuff like what happens next in this movie. This family does what any family that owns a dojo in Los Angeles and is beat up by organized crime from New York. Mm-hmm. They take the only sensible option, which is to move our entire family to Seattle. And do you guys notice? I forgot it was a blog I read that pointed this out. I didn't notice before, but, like, they really want to make sure that you know they are in Seattle. We get a Space Needle shot, then we get the road sign for it there in Seattle, then we get the Space Needle again, and then a, like, title card, Seattle.
Yeah, but then they pull into their new home and there's, like, gorgeous blue skies and they're clearly and back palm in trees. California. Like, I guess they just shot, like, a few days in Seattle. Like, second unit location stuff. So, like, okay, we're going to get in the Seattle staples, but then we're just going to film this all in California where we're all based out of.
Somebody that I read this from also pointed out that in the scenes where they're driving to Seattle, you only see Jason in the car. They don't pan on the parents at all. So they're like, oh yeah, they probably didn't want to drive everyone up there, just him. And of course, we later see some scenes of him and his girly around Seattle. So probably just a weekend they got up there for some scene shots. And then we get the move in into Seattle in this suspiciously Los Angeles looking suburban street.
Okay, stop. How many parents does he have?
He has a mom and a dad.
Okay, where's the mom, like, in this whole thing?
She shows up towards the end.
We see her a couple times.
The back of the head, though. I don't even think we see the front.
Yeah, we see the back of her head, and, like, but her son gets his ass whooped the whole time. My mom, like, my mom would notice if I had a bruise. Like, this guy gets whooped, and his dad's like, you can't be fighting. Where is the mom? Is she out for drinks? And what does she think about this? Like, what?
Oh, and we see her at the move-in. Remember, she tells him, like, help with the big boxes, which he basically F you moms, and grabs his own crap out of the back of the U-Haul
and takes
it to the garage. And that's when we meet Token. RJ.
Well said.
And of course, the first scene is him with a basketball, and he soon raps.
Yes, and he has the Michael Jackson gloves on. But I will say, he has something about him where anytime he's on the screen, the actor's name is J.W. Fales, I think. I kind of like, he becomes one of my favorite, like, sidekick or friends of the lead in the 80s. Like, he just brings it. I'm jumping ahead because I know we're kind of going through the plot here, but, like, the kind of, like, the dance where he kind of, like, machines the, you know, Jason and his love interest into dancing together. Like, the guy has charisma. I'm almost bummed when I look at his IMDb that he didn't have, like, a big acting career, because I'm such a fan of RJ in this. Yes,
he seems like a fun guy. Like, yeah,
yeah,
I agree.
Exactly, yeah,
like he's definitely the comic relief. 100%. I mean, he's both the token black guy and the comic relief, which is also right. an 80s trope, unfortunately.
100%.
But like when he's in it, it's like, you know, he loosens things up, because the yeah. rest of this time it's like a kid being bullied and getting his ass whooped and then hallucinating and
he's
getting into fights. Like, there's a lot going on. So yeah.
Yeah, and he, one thing that I'm sure we'll come back to, but in the couple times I watched this in preparation for this episode, rewatched it, I really warmed up to his character.
Yeah.
A bit in that yeah. he has all the lines, whether the jokes are good or bad. But the more I watch it, the more I just think, like, Jason's character is so goddamn boring.
Right.
Like, he's whiny yeah. and uninteresting. And the more I watch it, I feel like it's RJ being like, I'm just trying to bring some fun into this relationship because all you do is sit around and whine about everything.
Right.
Yeah. So it made me like him even more, that I'm like, oh, this is the friend that's just trying to like bring the mood up because you're such yeah. a boring asshole. That, like, so it made me like RJ. I like RJ. It's definitely how he's used.
I feel like the brooding hero, I don't know which place that's a trope from. I feel like it's from every place, but it's definitely right. we've seen in a lot of East Asian.
I think calling Jason yeah. brooding is being very generous.
Yeah, you know what I mean. It's kind of,
I do.
Because you don't want your hero, like, the idea, I mean, like, I feel like it's more common now with Deadpool, where you're like, I want to hit my hero to be a knucklehead. That's fun.
Right, right.
But I feel like back in the day, the hero has oh, yes. to be serious.
Right.
Yes. Know? 100%.
I mean, and they went that way hard. Speaking of A's, they went that way hard in Conan the Destroyer. There's no comic relief in the original Conan, but in Conan the Destroyer, there's a ton of comic relief, because Conan needs to have, we need to have fun in a Conan movie for some reason. And I feel like a lot of the 80s movies deteriorated, that you want this brooding hero, and then you need like the you know, as the straight man, if you will, and then the other guy's just a wacko. I mean, in Lionheart, it was the same thing. You had Jean-Claude yeah. Van Damme, and then you had the other guy with the really bad cauliflower.
That's true. Well, you know, RJ is Gosh. Not the only character that we are introduced to in the move-in scene. We are also introduced to my personal favorite character in the movie, with maybe one of the most memorable introductions ever. And that's Scott, played by Kent Liffam. During the move-in, this guy is just moving into his house in quote-unquote Seattle. And Scott is, for some reason, he's leaning against a car, eating an entire cake.
Best scene in the movie. This is the best. This is iconic. He's eating an entire chocolate cake with it with his hand, not a fork, his
right.
hand.
With his hand.
And there's a box of ding dongs on the hood of the car.
Did you not get like right. severe Francis vibes from Pee-wee's Big Adventure? Like, so much so that at one point he calls Jason Pee-wee, and I was like, oh
yeah.
So this is clearly an homage to Pee-wee. Like, we need another Francis type character. But this came out before Pee-wee's
yeah,
Big Adventure.
This is older than Pee-wee's
by several years, couple years. So
right.
it's like, I'm blown away by how much you know, that this is like a Francis derivative, but before him. Like, it's unbelievable. Scott is it like. Dom, you just said iconic, and that's why I'm mad. Like, how did I not know about Scott until a few years ago? Like, this
right,
is
right.
unbelievable.
It's just, I mean, he's eating cake in the way, as you said, it's not without a fork, like a toddler does. Like, my 8-year-old can eat cake more cleanly than this man who presumptively is, like, I guess he's supposed to be a teenager. But he's just mowing on. He's got it all over his face.
He threatens to take over the movie every time he's on screen. Like, that
oh, yeah.
is how powerful Scott is.
And also, he sounds like he's from Texas. Like, he's like... And also, what is his... And him in his neighborhood, he, like, what is his niche? So he's a kid, supposedly, who doesn't do yard work.
No,
And his father's mad at him. He's just yeah, he's shooting cans with a power washer.
Yeah.
Two,
which is amazing.
He has a feud with RJ, and yep. he never says why. He just quote has his reasons.
Yeah. Literally, he says that.
I have my reasons.
I have my reasons.
Three, he has a posse that he yep. has developed by bribing them with
fast food.
Fast food.
Yeah, he pays for their fast food. Yeah.
Which would work very well for a 17-year-old me.
That would work very well for 43-year-old me. I don't know what you're talking about. If someone's like, anytime you want to hang out, I've got like a bucket of burgers with me. That person is my best friend forever.
Well, if your audience, if you're wondering how I get Michael Huntone to help me sell my wife's wares at Comic-Con, we have a tradition where last night we get an obscene amount of White Castle. Obscene amount of White Castle, and we eat it.
That's true.
But also, let's talk about Scott. So he has he has the fast food posse.
Yep.
And he's a white belt at the karate school, and for some reason people listen to him. I don't know. Like, and he's friends with the girlfriend, and like, it's just a lot. It's a lot.
He does seem to know everybody, right? Yeah. Like, he's a player in that town.
Yeah, he really
somehow
is.
So I read somewhere that supposedly there was a scene that was in the script that was not filmed where they're at school, where Scott is like walking in the lunchroom and RJ like accidentally trips him and he ends up getting food, falling into his food and getting embarrassed, which I don't know why that would be embarrassing for it. Cause like his key move in this movie is just walking around with food, like grossly covering his entire face. So, but apparently in that moment that embarrassed, and that's why he has the grudge against RJ. But
right, at least there's,
I mean, we draw our own conclusions with this, right? This redneck sounding white guy just says he sees, which again, RJ is like the, comes across and is played as like the most harmless, nicest kid.
Such a nice gentleman.
Right. And he's walking outside and Scott's all of a sudden like pissed level 10. And we get the like, why do you hate him so much? I have my reasons. And I think we said to each other in the theater, we saw that. We're like, oh, wonder what those reasons are. Just the sight of a happy black kid walking in the parking lot would send this redneck white kid into a rage. Oh, I wonder what those reasons are. But he has his reasons.
Mike, I'm glad you quickly brought that up because, like, again, this is like the movie sort of, I don't know, but RJ's just wandering around in a parking lot like he's senile. Like, that's why I love this movie. Like, what?
Right, so they see him outside in the parking lot. Again, they have the mountain of burgers. Scott is within, like, two bites of the burger, gotten, like, ketchup and mustard all over his cheeks. Like, again, my 8-year-old can eat a burger less messy than this man. Oh, and the next scene, they're surrounding him in the parking lot. Like, he has stayed in the parking lot this long to have all these guys go outside and surround him.
And it's really uncomfy seeing, like, a bunch of white guys, like, surrounding a adorable young black child. Like, it's like,
right.
Oh, wow. Like, this movie just doesn't get America.
Yeah, that's what I mean by like it's the uncanny valley, because that little subtext, like like born and raised American in the 80s would be like,
ooh, I'm feeling weird.
Let's throw in some color in the on the bad guy side to make it a little less.
Yeah.
But no, they're just like, oh, whatever. We get this is what we have. It's happening. Yep.
Right.
100%.
Right. And luckily, RJ is saved by our hero Jason, and we get, I think it's the first time in the movie that RJ speaks the title "No Retreat, No Surrender." I love it anytime a movie says the title, and this time RJ says it. Frequently. Yeah.
Isn't it often after they say that they retreat? Like, I'm not crazy, right? They're always retreating while they're saying their catchphrase, which is not retreat. It's the opposite. I love this movie.
I know. But after the burger joint, we get to one really important scene, and that is the dojo humiliation, where he goes to the dojo because he just wants to practice martial arts, and oh, the bad guy's there. Our white belt friend who somehow has the ear of everybody in the dojo. Everybody loves Scott, apparently. So maybe it's just Jason and RJ that are assholes. But, Scott convinces them to play a trick on him and has Jay tells him one. Oh, this is a trope, right? I guess this is a trope that I love they introduce here. Scott sets Jason up because he says, oh, he's from Los Angeles. Oh, and I heard him say that he doesn't think Seattle karate is very good and L.A. karate is the best. And
oh, and he also said that they got into a fight. Let's keep that.
He does. He's like, he points to like, he gave me this and this and this. And I didn't even see like bruises on him where he pointed to, but I guess there were no
bruises. And Dean believes him 100%. There's no all question. The way. Like, this shady.
How unprofessional is this guy? Like, he's like, oh, this guy hurt my students. Instead of walking up to him and be like, are you attacking my students? Like, let's have a conversation because that's not how we do it. Yeah, he's like, okay, tough guy, let's see what you can do, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, it's terrible.
Dom, in your gym, when you have someone come in from out of town, do you immediately wonder, like, I wonder what they think about Buffalo Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? We need to defend the honor of Syracuse Buffalo Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in this gym.
I don't give a shit.
Well, it means something big to
usually,
these guys.
Usually I'm trying my best to not make a fool of myself because jiu-jitsu is hard and it never is not hard. And like, yeah, no, this is not how martial arts works. When someone from out of town comes in, like if you think they're a troublemaker, typically you tell your students that like, you know, you don't want to get hurt. So just watch yourself. You know, it's not like... This is very Hong Kong trope, this idea like, you know, my kung fu style is better than your kung fu style. Ooh. And then they proceed to beat his ass. And by the way, the guy that beats his ass, the African-American dude, Sugarfoot Cunningham. Like, this guy is tippity-top.
You can tell because he is like Donnie Yen speed with those punches. Like,
yeah, he's nuts. Like, he's up. Yeah. Like, this is like not Thai kickboxing. This is the more like Western-style kickboxing. Like, Sugarfoot Cunningham did that. And he also did karate. Like, we're talking about, like, they have a legit karate expert just sprinkled in there.
Nice.
I guarantee you he could have whooped Jean-Claude Van Damme to high heaven. Like,
even Kurt was like, wow, this guy's really fast. Like, in that fight, you could tell. Yeah, he's super fast.
Yeah. He's, like, a multiple times over world champion in karate and kickboxing.
I'd like to note he's not American. He's Canadian.
Canadian, yes, right. Thank you.
Gotta throw that out there.
Yep, thank you. North American martial arts world, I'll say.
We're way too close to Canada to piss them off.
Yes, that's right. We love you, Canada. We're adjacent. We're fans.
I would have taken five more fights with him. If they could have stretched, I would have loved that.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's a failing of this movie. People who make exploitation fight movies decided to make a teen drama.
I don't know. I feel like it makes it more memorable.
Memorable. Yeah. I mean, if your foot gets run over by a car, that's memorable too. But
well, don't worry. Pete comes back later in this film. And I think it's time for us to take a little break here. But don't worry, we'll come back too and dive even more as the bad times in Seattle for the Stillwell family continue. But we will be back.
Hello, listeners. This is Richard B. Cologne reminding you all to check out the Behind the Glass Gallery podcast hosted by myself and Kwajay Donnell. Every month, we interview the latest First Friday featured gallery artists and dive deep into their passion, drive, and motivation beyond what they display on our gallery walls each month in downtown Rochester, New York. So please, if you haven't yet, subscribe and give us a listen. Also, don't forget to check out our monthly artist receptions every first Friday of the month from 6 to 8 p.m. 240 East Main Street at the Mercantile on Main. Hoping to see you all behind the glass.
Welcome back, Punchy Pals, to Once Upon a Time in the 80s. And tonight we are taking on No Retreat, No Surrender. So when we last left our hero, Jason Sitwell, he was having bad times in Seattle. But things turned around quick. Another layer of the onion is unveiled as we are introduced to Kelly. We get one of the many montages. We get Jason and Kelly romping around Seattle, I guess. So once again, the Space Needle. We soon sojourn to Kelly's birthday party and discover that Kelly is the younger sister of the sensei of the dojo Jason got humiliated at. And I love that, again, we get our buddy Scott introduced again. And how is he introduced? The other way that a fat guy, especially an 80s movie, would get introduced, if not stuffing his face with cake or burgers, it's doing a cannonball. So, of course, all the guys from the dojo are there, and Jason comes and brings her a really unique present.
rabbit. Nice. Like, he's swinging for the fences. And clearly it worked because she's like, thank you for the bunny. Kissy, kissy.
Lots of kissy.
And what's up with, like, are they, pretty much a thing right now. And Dean thinks 100%. Dean thinks he can just grope his way into her heart. This guy's buying her animals. Like, he's wearing a tie.
Yeah, but do you see the shirt that Dean is wearing? That was an impressive shirt.
I rest my case.
It was just one of these shirts that I like only existed in the
80s. Yeah.
It's true. It's true.
When men's shirts showed off their midriffs. Like, right, the 80s was... I'm glad I was between 0 and 10 in the 80s and not between 40 and whatever I am now.
So we discover that apparently Dean thinks he's with Kelly and quickly adopts a get off my property attitude with Jason on this woman.
Yep.
But either way, she is quite smitten, and Dean is very angry.
And Scott rats him out. Yeah. Scott's like, Dean, can you believe it? Like,
and I love that, like, when Scott brings Dean in to see it.
Yes.
Which is kind of rude to your friend. Like, you want your friend to see this girl that he clearly is crushing on, whether healthily or not, but see her kissing someone.
Like, but then holds him back, too, so he can watch and be like,
right, like, he's ready to fight.
Yeah.
Like, what is the plan here? I'm going to beat his ass in her living room, and she's going to love me.
You know, that's a movie trope too. Like,
sure.
Oh, 100%.
I feel like that's a movie trope that only worked in like feudal Europe in real life. Like, aside from a duel for the heart of the maiden. Oh, yeah. I'll take the winner and let the one I love die bleeding out. No.
Right. And then I love that Dean and Scott's great plan is first spilling a drink on him, throwing cake at him.
Yep.
And then doing the old somebody gets on their knees behind him and I push him over.
Yeah. It's classic. I don't think that's classic. Like,
it is. And then, you know, we get the humiliation, and I mean, it works because Jason is super humiliated. So humiliated, in fact, that as he runs out of the party, he basically assaults Kelly, like pushes her away.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
Like, she didn't do anything.
Nope.
And she's clearly is like yelling at them.
Yeah, she's very supportive of Jason during this struggle he's having.
Right,
she's still ready to make out, and he just kind of shoves her away. Like,
he's like, my ego's way more important than my libido, baby. Goodbye.
right. And then he runs out of there, and we won't get another great montage that reminded me of one of the movies that is very reminiscent of this one, or this is clearly inspired by Rocky IV. We get a trauma montage where he's driving and upset, except instead of like having watched his friend die as Rocky did and having the montage, it's just him getting beat up at a party. And he's like remembering back to these scenes that happened like 5 minutes ago.
There's
no easy way out. There's no shortcut home. There's no easy way out.
This is before Giving in
can't be wrong.
But I love that he goes, you know, doesn't go see his friend who, just again, a note, there's this huge party that clearly all these people are invited to. Who's the one person that's not in? RJ's not here.
Yeah.
And notice, like, everybody from the dojo is there. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe except Pete Cunningham. So the one black guy at the dojo is also not there. But they have their reasons.
So this went from a bad movie to a racist movie. Like the schlock apologist is going to have trouble now. You're putting him in a very precarious place.
Yeah, I'm cornered now.
Whether intentionally or not, instead of going to see RJ, you know, the friend that is always there for him or his parents, Jason goes to the one thing that really matters to him, an inanimate stone. And that stone is, as seen earlier in the movie, Bruce Lee's grave. And I had to look this up. So it's like this perfect combination. They go to Seattle. We never know why they're in Seattle, like why Seattle. But it just so happens to be where Bruce Lee is buried. And we got moments there before where he got to see Bruce Lee's grave. I looked it up and like that's actually Bruce Lee's grave.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they had any licensing to be there, or it's just like they showed up and
Can you can film someone's? I'm actually interested in the legal ease for this. Like, if I wanted
me too,
to,
yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question. So, you know, I mentioned this before. This is, and it'll get even worse, one of the most egregious examples of Bruce exploitation. That, and this is one of the things that I
I'm cutting you off. It is the most egregious.
Oh, yeah.
The most egregious.
Bruce, we're going to use his tombstone.
Yeah.
And right, so that's where I wonder, like, did Bruce Lee's family know about this? Or was someone like, hey, they don't just have some guy named, like, Bruce Lee pretending to be Bruce? But they actually have his grave in this movie.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Did they know about? I would love to know.
And have an actor play him, which we'll get to, of course.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah, it's what's the word I'm looking for? It's tone deaf, insensitive. Yeah, it's very insensitive.
Mind boggling.
Because if, like, I mean, if my pop was a great whatever, and then they just went to his gravesite and filmed some actor at his gravesite and then had some bald guy with a beard, they should hire me, a bald guy with a beard play him, like, in a movie, I'd be livid. I would be like, oh my god, did you ask me for permission? I'd first call my brother and sister and be like, did you sign off on this? Because I sure as hell didn't.
Yeah, that's, I really want to know, like, did Shannon know about this? But yeah, he goes to, instead of going to any living people that he actually knows, maybe because he's a sociopath, I don't know, like, he goes to a grave and cries and whines at his grave. And soon after that, we see that, like, crying and whining is a family trait, because he goes home and with this, like, split ripped up shirt that he wears for basically half of the rest of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And his dad catches him, and rather than, like, ask him, his son clearly is upset, has been manhandled, and rather than try to help him, his dad has his own little crying hissy fit and destroys his garage and yells at him. And
a lot, right? Like, wow. Like, in terms of 80s dads, this guy, he's memorable, but he's a handful.
Yeah, two tropes I'm noticing since we're tallying up tropes. One, no police. Like, if my kid, okay, yeah. I'm sorry, I know I'm a martial artist, and I want my kids to learn martial arts, and I want them to be able to defend themselves. But if my kid comes home with a ripped shirt and a black eye and clearly was beaten up, I'd be like, one of two things is going to happen. You're either going to tell me who did this, or I'm calling the police, because you can't. No, it's assault. Like, come on.
You mean you're not going to destroy his home gym and throw away all his magazines?
After I call the cops. Like, so cops are never called in an 80s movie, ever.
Correct.
But this is an interesting thing, because the parents in an 80s movie are typically, like, out in space. Mm-hmm. Like, they're either drunk, or they're at parties, or they're just not paying attention.
Right. They're ineffectual.
Yeah, this dad is not that. He's not in space, but in another way. So we're mm-hmm. still troping it a little bit.
And I can't remember one of the many layers of this movie, again, peeling back the onion of No Retreat, No Surrender, there's mm-hmm. also this, like, side plot where we see his dad as a bartender now. So he owned an entire dojo that apparently was respected enough to have mobsters from New York fly all the way to LA from New York to take it over. Uh-huh. And he runs away to Seattle, and he's now just working as a bartender.
Right.
So I guess he's done with the dojo. He's done with the dojo business now.
You are correct.
But we get that moment too, where his dad is humiliated at the bar by this guy that's kind of
pours a drink on him.
But either way, he, instead of consoling his son, he drives him away, who finally, after crying to Bruce's grave and getting basically abused by his dad emotionally, drives him back to RJ, who's there to save the day. Again, RJ really is the hero of this movie.
He really
because
is.
Because he helps him out. And, you know, even though he's got his shower cap on and looks like he's chilling, he immediately knows an abandoned house that is the place that Jason can escape to start training. So we get the house. This, again, it's an abandoned house that Jason finds and brings his stuff to. So somehow he snuck all those out, but he still got his ripped shirt on.
Now, did you two think that the house, like he lives there now, right? Because eventually, I'm
he
jumping
is there
ahead, but
a lot.
Yeah, like he catches up with his mom at some point, and she doesn't register that he's moved out. She's just like, you know, he's like, oh, hey, mom, blah, blah, blah. I even forget what was said, but it's just like, he moved out. Why are you not being like,
I thought he didn't move out. I thought he just would like hang out in an abandoned house.
I think it's just okay. his dojo, basically.
The this fact that we weirdness. Can't follow this is not our fault. I'm like, I just want to say that. Like, we're three pretty smart guys. Geneseo isn't a bad school. Like, we're pretty smart guys. And we're just like, wait, he moved out? Does he have a mother? Who's his mother? The dad? He's a bartender. He's a, you know.
What he does have is an obscene amount of candles. That
yes,
there are many candles in this house. Yeah.
Like, was he planning on bringing his girlfriend there? And he's like, and Bruce Lee shows up, and he's like, "Hey, we're doing martial arts instead," because that house is pretty romantic, like with all the candles.
He has so many candles in there that it would make a Bengals video blush.
They're even unsafely on his exercise equipment. At one point, he's using the wooden thing, and there's candles on it.
Yes. So this is, we are at this house, and this is where we take Bruce Blightation to an even more obscene level. If it's not just enough to have Bruce's grave here, we now get introduced to the ghost of Bruce Lee, who we have seen before in this movie on a poster, and a man comes in who does not look like Bruce Lee.
No, he doesn't. Why wouldn't he have the glasses on? Like, put some sunglasses on this guy. Like, that would sell it better.
It's Bruce Lee from friggin' from Fist of Fury. Like, he's wearing the outfit and everything.
Yeah.
So I looked this guy up. He has actually been in a bunch of Bruce Blightation stuff. Mm-hmm. He was in like Game of Death 2 and like a bunch of other movies. Like he.
Yeah. So Tai Chung Kim is his name, and he is so legit in that he wasn't just in Game of Death 2, he was in Game of Death, the original one, and was one of two stand-ins for Bruce after, you know, Bruce died in the middle of making that movie. So, you know, he kind of legit, and I'll say to his credit, he has the mannerisms down really well. The hand movements and that are, like, they feel very authentic, right? Like a very... like very reminiscent of Fist of Fury in there. He just face wise looks nothing like him.
No.
I love it. So we talk about, you know, this is inspired by Karate Kid. Rather than get Miyagi, we are going to have him trained by actually Bruce Lee, ghost Bruce Lee, who just shows up. And again, we aren't sure if he's moved in or what, but there is a lot of time in this house where he is training him.
Also, let's point out that, like, it's almost three quarters of the way of the movie into it. And to introduce this plot thread of ghost Bruce Lee showing up to train you, that's a whole movie. And in this movie, because they're trying to shoehorn so much 80s into this, that it's just like, I don't want to call it an aside. It's an important plot point. But it just seems like, oh, like, you're just starting a whole nother movie where this boy... is hallucinating Bruce Lee and he's going to train him. Like that's a whole 90 minute movie, but no, we're going to dedicate 20 minutes to this. He's going to train him real good and send him out.
Right. We get this like interspersed again, more montages. We get training here at the house. Then we get some really, really interesting training montages around like town in like a playground where he's running around. He's doing push-ups, sit-ups. So many. Weighted runs.
It's Rocky shit. He's doing Rocky.
It is. So yeah, it's very, very shit, Rocky right. Reminiscent. You know, amongst that, RJ helps him. Oh, before I get to that, I want to point out that I do enjoy that. Again, this is where I think RJ is the hero of this movie. One brought him the house, right? But I love that amongst that, we have that scene where RJ comes to visit Jason at the house and, like, through the window sees... Yeah. Jason training with Bruce, but it's just Jason.
Yeah,
like,
so good.
And he's just laughing at him like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah. What's this nut doing?
Do you think, let me ask you, do you think that ghost Bruce Lee was really there or Jason hallucinated all this?
Yeah. To me, Jason moved out of his house and has just lost it. He's snapped from reality, and he's hallucinating Ghost Bruce Lee because his father's not there to guide him, even though his father's he's an instructor of martial arts.
But now he's just a bartender, I guess.
Now he's just a bartender getting...
drinks poured at him.
Getting handled.
I actually think that Jason doesn't exist, and this movie never happened. What happened is Scott ate so much cake, he went into a diabetic coma, and this entire movie is a hallucination caused by a spike in blood sugar.
Holy shit. Ooh.
I hope that your science segment is laugh. About diabetic comas.
Oh, okay.
It's a little insensitive. Let's take it easy.
Listen. So yeah, the training happens. He introduces, in a lot of these movies, we get the talking about tropes, the like signature move. And we're introduced to it here with the, I don't know, what would you call the signature move here? It's like a leg being tied up and
yeah,
jump kick.
So there's a couple signature moves. So what he does is you got the leg being tied up, and then you got the roundhouse kick from that. And then the other signature move is when the leg gets caught on the shoulder, he does the Bruce Lee spin.
Oh, kick, right.
Which is from Enter the Dragon when he.
Oh, right.
He does this big kick to O'Hara and kicks him to hell. Right.
Right.
And that was, it's all, and also he does a lot of these spinning back kicks and spinning roundhouse kicks. It's all the good Bruce stuff. He does a good job at it too. It looks good.
Yeah.
And he ties it into like Drunken Master stuff too, where like, remember Jackie Chan would do that like sit up, but his legs are in the air and he'd hit that board. Like there's a lot of Drunken Master training on this too. Like, again, same production company, so they knew a good thing when they saw it. But they're touching a lot of montages.
With some of those training montages, one, there's, I mean, the most remarkable one is the bridge that he's doing with RJ.
Yeah, that was something.
While he's eating ice cream. So
yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. But also, he's doing these, like, push-ups on a picnic table in a playground and these like hanging sit-ups that it looks like he has brought a board to a jungle gym and tied it onto it.
Yeah.
And at some point he's doing this like with his shirt off. Mm-hmm. And I'm just imagining like pan right and there's just all these like mothers with their kids. Like, what the hell is this guy doing?
Yep.
I feel like working out outdoors is a very LA thing and not a very Seattle thing.
Okay.
probably.
I don't know, but like.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like Seattle, you probably don't have a lot of days where you're like feeling cozy working out at a playground with your shirt off. But, you know, he trains and, you know, before too long, man, he is pretty freaking cut. You know, I'm starting to feel myself getting fatter, you know, as he's getting more cut.
But yes, he's in very good shape. Yeah, of course. But like, he never wasn't. Like, let's think about it. We're talking about Karate Kid. Karate Kid, Ralph Macchio enjoyed doing karate from a book, but aside from that, was not an athlete in any way.
Right.
And then Mr. Miyagi trains him and he becomes just good enough to win. You know, right. And then the next movies, he gets a little more beefy, but this guy, his father was an owner of a karate school. I wouldn't have messed with it. I would not have messed with that kid in high school if I was
right.
That was like he's big, you know, he clearly knows martial arts and has an interest in it. Like, he's not starting from scratch. And honestly, like when he fights all those idiots, I'm like, dude, you just need to train a little bit. And I think you could take most of these guys. That's really the only real fight scene where I feel that there's any like drama or suspense is the ones with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Because it's Jean-Claude Van Damme. He looks like he could kill you. These other guys, they don't look like they could kill. Even Sugarfoot, who could probably kill you, they painted him in such a way that he didn't look like he could kill you. But man, like by the end, I'm like, finally, I'm going to see something where there's some suspense.
Yeah.
And I wish it stretched out a little bit more. I wish they did more with it.
Well, I love kind of the conclusion to Ghost Bruce is he completes this like elevated leg jump kick roundhouse.
Yeah.
And as soon as he makes that move, Ghost Bruce is gone. Like,
he just leaves. Yeah.
Like, I mean, he starts out with the whole, the character thing, talking of this like philosophy of martial arts. But in the end, to like, I guess the point that he was there is he just wanted him to learn this one move so that, and just the off chance that you have your leg caught up high, you would have this move to use. And that we don't know if that will happen, but we'll have to see.
No, Ghost Bruce is clairvoyant. Come on, get your act together.
Wouldn't have liked to see him as like a hologram a la Star Wars, like in the end, like just smiling, or Miyagi, like they needed a callback towards the end when Jason wins the day of just Ghost Bruce watching.
Ghost Bruce leaves and Jason is reunited with his dad through the magic of fighting, which his dad was very, very against until he gets attacked by the same bad guys that could be related to Scott or not. You know, they call him Karate Man and attack him in the parking lot, but Jason is there. I love that Jason doesn't just go to save his dad. He barrel rolls somersaults over the hood of his car and beats the hell out of the bad guys, one of whom is the writer of the film, Keith Strandberg.
Oh, that's right.
Guy deserved to be punched.
But he saves his dad. Now his dad is not mad that he's fighting because, you know, he just saved him from getting attacked.
Okay, what is the moral stance of his father? Because I'm a little confused.
I know, he's all over the place.
I was under the impression, like, people have different opinions on what martial arts are for, so I'm not going to say martial arts are for X or Y or Z. But the impression I got from this man and his philosophy was karate is not used for aggression. It's used for defense.
Yep.
And typically the logic behind that is it's peace through strength kind of thing. You don't start none, but you finish. So like, you know, if you protect yourself, you protect your loved ones, but you're not a jerk. That's the law. I think I got this. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So like literally, if you're walking in a parking lot and four drunken dirtbags try to beat you up, isn't that the definition of the perfect time to use karate? I can't think of a better one. Like, that's what you're supposed to use it for. Every time Jason has gotten to a fight, he is not the aggressor. Like, every time he's fought, it's been based on his dad's philosophy. Why wasn't he like, I was attacked first, and I was attacked first, and I couldn't run away, so I got into a fight, which is exactly what karate's for. Knucklehead.
Right. And after this fight, his dad is fine with it. He's like, this reunites them. So.
But didn't his dad sort of just kind of take a back seat and Jason kind of takes on all these older gentlemen and his dad sort of just watches, right? He doesn't engage.
Yeah.
Well, his leg's still messed up with this impression
I
get.
Right. That must have been
like one hell of a leg breakage because, I mean, I feel it's not an insubstantial amount of time has passed here.
He has a forever limp after that.
It was a really bad break. Well, when you get attacked by the muscles from Brussels, it's going to leave a lasting impact.
Yeah, absolutely.
As Pete Cunningham will find in the scenes that we're about to come up to. So, this leads us all to the climactic conclusion. And, we're brought back to the thread that we really haven't seen since the beginning. The dojo overlords of North America, the New York gangsters, are now, surprisingly, in Seattle to take over Seattle Karate. And how are they going to do that? By an exhibition fight?
Yeah,
apparently. With karate teams? I like that they get team names. So, again, using this fantasy world that Karate Kid introduced where karate is the most important thing in all these communities. And if there's a karate exhibition, then of course your entire town shows up. Mm-hmm. I guess you should say entire, like this is supposed to be Seattle. So there's maybe 100 people in this. So if you look at it from there, it's really not a lot of people, but it's everyone that we know is there, including RJ in a real slick Playboy shirt. But yeah, we get this fight. I like that they have team names, like the Seattle group is the Seattle Sidekicks, which is kind of a wimpy name.
It is, yeah.
It's
versus the Manhattan Maulers. Right. So, these guys are back. And now we got, remember how this this group was going to take over the dojos of North America. Well, now they're here in Seattle, and we get our exhibition fight where the Seattle Sidekicks are going to take on the Manhattan Maulers, and Jason's just there to watch. And I love that one. So we talk about like super 80s things. The ring announcer for this is he's introducing the teams. He has like this, these like super frilly tuxedo shirt that like these things were only seen in like the 80s. Right. And as he's introducing it, I like super slick back haired bad guy just interrupts him and is like, no.
Straight out of WWE or at that time.
Right.
WWE.
Oh, yeah.
Right. No, I'm not going to have this team fight all our guys. They're going to fight just one guy. And that guy is the guy we've really been waiting to see fight all movie for, especially us who went in. Now, knowing him, Jean-Claude Van Damme, who comes out as, of course, his name is Ivan, right?
And we haven't seen him since the opening scene, right? Where he takes care of the father, yeah.
Right, so now he's back and fighting and quickly makes mincemeat, I guess, out of the entire Seattle dojo, including, I was reading, so he fights Pete Cunningham and apparently, like, really knocked him out. Yeah. I read there was like conflicting reports. Some people had said like, oh, Van Damme was really dangerous on set because he kept hitting people.
Yes.
But I read other people said like he did, but it wasn't like intentional. It wasn't that he was reckless. It's just, this is one of his first films. And I know in the commentary, the writer said, well, it's just that he's came from, and we've talked about this before. Like Van Damme was a legit martial artist. He had a lot of experience fighting, and he had said he came from a world of full contact, so he wasn't as comfortable with how you pull punches and kicks. And I guess so when he's fighting Sugarfoot there, he did a spinning kick and actually connected with him and knocked him out. But apparently, like, they didn't film it right, so they had to do it again. And he hit him again and knocked him out a second time, and that's what's in the movie.
Yeah, and Corey Yoon would actually scold him and, like, direct him, like, you cannot do this. And then he'd do it again. Like, right. I just can't believe. And I guess it shows this power of Van Damme's, like, charisma where he's a complete asshole. And he just, like, goes up the ladder in terms of, like, okay, I'm eventually going to be in Bloodsport and people will adore me. But, like, he's apparently from, and there was eventually a lawsuit even I was reading in terms of his conduct on set. Like, that guy's a menace.
Right. That's where I heard, like, some people said, because there were a number of people from the movie, I think, in that lawsuit that, like, came out.
Yeah.
And said, like, no, he didn't intentionally, like, and he was really, oh, that was what they said. In the first time he knocked Pete out, he was so upset about it that, like, as soon as he hit him, he, like, ran over to him to, like, check on him and make sure he's okay.
So it killed the scene. Said,
that ruined the shot, so we have to do it again. And hit him again. So
that sounds probably what happened. Probably, you know, it was probably a mistake. I mean, you know, you got to be a pretty big. Also, that would be stupid to be like, no, I'm going to hit you and never work in Hollywood again. Like, I feel like,
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And also, these are stuntmen. They don't strike stuntmen in professional martial arts. They don't strike me as the type to be like, I can't believe he hit me. They're probably like, it's Tuesday, you know, whatever.
Right. Right. Yeah. So he, either way, again, Pete survived and has had a long career. Sounds like he's still doing good, I believe. Anyways, you know, eventually he has to fight Ian, the world U.S. champion something, Kelly's brother, and beats him. But the Keith was saying in the commentary, I guess, that the actor that plays Ian, Ron Punnell, is again a like credited martial artist, like whatever championships or again.
You can tell.
And he said that he, for his reputation, did not want to show himself get beat. And, you know, they had the debate like, well, that's what's in the script. You need to lose. So they ended up coming up with the idea of Ivan cheating so that Ian wouldn't get beat legitimately. So he gets the, like, rips the rope out and starts choking him. Like, I love that he just starts choking him in the middle of the ring.
It was great. Yeah. That whole fight was great. Like,
so good.
Like, the best part of the movie for me, hands down, is where he fights Ian. Like, mm-hmm. and like the sister comes up with the wooden chair, you know?
Right. Not any of the steel chairs that are everyone is sitting in, but grabs the stool.
Yeah.
The
honestly, I'd rather get hit by one of those folding steel chairs than a wooden stool. Like, no way. It's that doesn't fold. That's just going to go bonk. Yeah. Like, I love that fight where he flings him. And then when he escapes that, he flings him over like the rope. So he gets tied up in it. And I'm like, this is awesome.
Yeah, oh yeah, so he's just completely rampaging, like knocks the ref out. I mean, he's like full on pro wrestling heel now. Like the sneering face, he is just going.
I'm the best.
Right, and I love that. Like everything about this scene is so reminiscent of Rocky IV.
But again, like. The weird thing is this was made before Rocky IV even came out. So it's like, you want to call this movie out. Yeah, because Rocky IV came out in 85, but they filmed this in 84. So it's
good point. Yep, you're right.
It's interesting that you're like, I wanted, throughout the movie, I'm like, oh, like again, like just Francis with, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I'm like, oh my God, this is clearly a Pee-wee ripoff. But nope, right. Like it's there. It's doing it before these cultural... you know, like touchstones have
right. done. Well, I feel like time. Rocky being the American Fighter was still kind of there. Like, I don't think
100%.
This wasn't, an innovative movie.
No, absolutely not.
Americans versus Russians was definitely not like a
100%. No,
right. That was out there, but
yeah.
So, and again, Kelly tries to save her brother. That doesn't work. What is Jean-Claude like slaps her or something, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that sets Jason off. And that's where we get our final, the showdown. And I love that when Jason shows up in the ring, Ivan Van Damme is like, oh, it's you. Like,
yeah.
He really remembered however long ago they had this confrontation in LA. Yeah. And it wasn't even like the guy that, like he was, I would think to them, this organized crime syndicate, he's just some kid that was in the dojo that, it was one of several people that Jean-Claude Van Damme beat up in that scene, but somehow he remembers him.
Mm-hmm. But have we talked about, I don't want to, again, this sort of is the meat of the movie to me in terms of Jean-Claude. He does his split, his resting split where he's just hanging on the ropes. I just love it. Like he shows up fully formed, like in terms of, you know, why we love him. Like he's just,
I kind of wish this was the first Jean-Claude Van Damme scene I've ever seen. I really do. not just at all. Like you said, you failed as a child not seeing this movie. Like I feel the same thing in this part of the movie. The rest of the movie, the last 10 minutes of the movie, I wish I was like an 8-year-old, and like I was staying over my grandmother's house because she had HBO. I watched stuff I wasn't supposed to watch. I'm going to bed, Dom. You can stay up and watch TV. Okay, Grandma, good night. Channel 6, baby. Woo! Anyway, so like, I wish this movie was on because I would have been like, who is this psycho with the slick back hair and clearly the super stretchy leg muscles? This guy's awesome.
Oh, yeah. So great.
Like, I would have been so much more excited about seeing Bloodsport next than the rest of those movies.
Right. I love that you said he came out fully formed. Like, he's got the split.
Yeah.
He's got the crazy faces. Yeah, they have this great fight. And what a surprise. Part of it involves Jason getting his leg caught up at shoulder height. Mm-hmm. And he gets to use the move.
He's clairvoyant. Like, he's the Muad'Dib. He's clairvoyant. He sees the future.
I mean, it's very much, right, it's like Karate Kid, where there's this one special move that he learned, and what a surprise. This special move is going to be the key to win the day.
Hell yeah.
Dom, which is a martial artist? Which special move is more impressive to you? This, the Bruce Lee-ish flying kick or the crane kick?
Oh. I don't do kicks, so they both seem kind of superfluous to me. So I'm backing away from that one. I gotta say, Bruce Lee doing an entire spinning kick, or in this case, Jason doing Bruce Lee's spinning kick, where he does a full 360 in the air. Like, come on, that's wild.
Oh yeah, the chin check kick is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know how practical it is, but like, I mean, You're definitely getting some phone numbers if you do that in public. Like, that's crazy.
Right. Yeah. No retreat, no surrender. Dom, do you have something scientific for us?
With science.
Yes, science.
Science.
It's not rocket science. Just say yes and we'll move on.
Science.
I don't think science knows, actually.
Blinded me with science.
All right, here we are with a very special pseudoscience segment.
All right, this is our first ever pseudoscience segment, because with this one, I was thinking of talking about the science of chocolate cake, but it'll just make y'all hungry. So instead, I'm going to talk about ghost hunting. And unlike most of my science segments, which hopefully educate and teach you something about the real world, we're going to talk about something that is most likely bullshit. All right, so let's dig into it. So ghost hunting is also called paranormal investigations. Para means next to normal, so paranormal. First, I want to talk about why it's a pseudoscience, because it's not just an opinion. People are like, well, scientists just have their opinions. No, it's not an opinion. What makes something a pseudoscience versus a science is a science relies on falsifiable hypotheses, meaning that, you know, a hypothesis is a statement. And if you make a statement, that statement, you can falsify it. You can say, that was wrong. And if you do that, you're doing science. But if you make a statement and you cannot say, this is wrong, you're not doing science. And most ghost hunters and paranormal things, what makes them pseudoscience is the fact that you can always end when you get results that don't jive with your hypothesis, you can always say something like, well, that's what they want you to think, you know, or something like that. And that's the problem is that. So anyway, ghost hunting is pretty old. Like, I feel like it's been done forever. The idea of ghosts in the afterlife is probably as old as humanity itself. But in, like, Western culture, it was really got popular in the 19th century in something called the spiritualist era. And that was when, you know, a lot of, I guess, Victorian times it would be, and people got really interested in, like, seances and communicating with ghosts and something like that. And then it died down, and then it picked back up hard in the 2000s with reality TV. So if you're not a fan of reality TV and you don't think it's having a negative impact on society, well, guess what? Now more people believe in ghosts because of it. So wah wah. Physical evidence of ghosts they call ectoplasm. I'm sure you've seen Ghostbusters and the ectoplasm, which is like mucus, right? But it's any type of physical evidence of a ghost is matter from a ghost is called ectoplasm, and which means a form that is outside, so outside the ghost, right? We don't have any, you know, and that's what makes it falsifiable. If someone's like, I have ectoplasm, I'd be like, okay, show me, and like, eh, and that's where that's the problem, because if we had a record of ectoplasms, we would study it and find out what it is, but we don't have any. All right, so there's a whole range of techniques that these ghost hunters use. And some are funny, some are pretty interesting, some are actually actual technical techniques that a real scientist would use to detect something that isn't a ghost. So, for example, surveys of historical sites and accounts and interview people and collecting data that way. And what happens is people will make claims, but the problem is the ghost hunter will go to check those claims and they don't really find them. Often it's a con, but sometimes it's like, we did the same thing you did and nothing happened. Cameras can be still cameras, then video cameras, and now it's night vision cameras and infrared cameras and all these cameras that range across a whole spectrum of things, because, you know, who knows where on the electromagnetic spectrum a ghost is. EMF meters, which is electromagnetic field meters, which detect any part of the electromagnetic field. Sometimes it can be a wide range, sometimes it can be a very focused range, but whatever. So supposedly when there's a ghost in the room,
the meter will go off and you'll be like, yeah, it's a ghost. Well, you know, and once again, that's not falsifiable because you'd be like, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of X-ray radiation occurring at spot X. And then that was a coincidence. I was anyway, there's a lot of X-ray radiation at spot X. You know, it must be a ghost. And you're like, well, how do you know that? And then it could be something else. And then the ghost hunters are like, it's a ghost. And that's the problem, is they don't dismiss other alternative hypotheses. Ambient temperature. When ghosts come in the room, does it get warmer? Does it get colder? So you might have seen like Sixth Sense, you know, and the Sixth Sense was like, is a ghost in the room because it's cold? The little kid can see it and everyone else is like, whoa, it's cold in here. You know, like that kind of thing. Same idea. Now they use thermal cameras, which can create an image like Predator. You know, same idea. Audio recordings, you know, leaving a tape recorder out, then all of a sudden a ghost will be around and go, ooh, or something like that. Geiger counters, because, you know, ghosts are radioactive. Motion sensors, because they can detect a ghost, but you can't. I don't know, whatever. There's all kinds of stuff. Like, and then it gets weird. Like, there's this thing called a dowsing rod, right? And what it is it used to be a stick, and now they make them artificially. And I want you to imagine a Y-shaped stick. And what happens is people walk around, and supposedly the stick will lead them using magic to something. And they used to use these to find water. They didn't find water. And now they use them to find spirits. And guess what? They don't find spirits. Another one that I thought was interesting are technologies that allow for you to access the ghost, like radio or TV. They call them ghost boxes. Ghost boxes. So, like, the spirit can't speak to you with your ears, with its voice in your ears, so it has to use some sort of technological medium, like a radio to the spirit world or a TV to the spirit world. And so you look for stuff in the static or, you know, like that. One day I'd like to do a science segment on static, but that's besides the point. Anyway, you know, and like I said, no one's found anything definitive. It's not like the Ring Girl has come up to the TV and been like, hey, I'm here. It hasn't happened. Ouija boards, I think they need no introduction. And then people. And, you know, you got psychics, mediums, clairvoyants, demonologists, exorcists, clergy, you know, the little short lady from Poltergeist that goes, this house is clear. Yeah, like that kind of thing. And some of them are con artists and some of them are believe it and are just taking a feeling and moving with it. And yeah, there's a lot of legwork that's gone into ghost hunting, and they've never found one that has been accepted by the scientific community. Now, yes, I know you could be like, well, you know, if we found out there were ghosts, society would fall down, so it's government conspiracy to hide them. And like, I'm not saying that's impossible, but, you know, you have to... Part of science is good faith. Part of science is saying that, okay, scientists and researchers look for things and they report their data honestly, and there's no conspiracy to cover it up. So we kind of make the assumption in science that we're not being lied to. And of course it's possible, but I seriously doubt that every researcher that's ever looked for ghosts has been somehow suppressed. So I don't think they're ghosts. And so if anyone's looking to hire Ghost Bruce Lee to teach them Jeet Kune Do in an abandoned warehouse, I'm sorry. It's probably not going to work out. Aliens might be able to teach you it, but not Bruce. Sorry. That's all I got.
All right. Well, that was very informative, Dom, as always. Or excuse me, ding-dongs, Demore. So again, we're in our 80s season. Once upon a time. In the 80s, we've seen, I think, a very 80s movie. Just one last quick question for you guys as we kind of close this out. What do you think was, in your opinion, the most 80s part of this movie?
I'll start just again, like RJ serves as almost like a little microcosm of the movie because he checks so many boxes. He's breakdancing, he's rapping, he's doing Michael Jackson, you know, he's got the white glove on. He shows up with like the black shoes and the white socks at one point to the dance scene. Like, I've never seen anything as 80s as RJ. It's unbelievable.
I have nothing to add. That's exactly what I was thinking. No, I mean it. I mean it. I'm not doing this for laughs. I mean it. Like, I was thinking everything RJ does is just a stereotype.
Before we close out, I want to say that this movie spawned a franchise, which, again, is unbelievable. There are five of these movies. And why I love it is well, I don't know why I love it, but this is just chaos in terms of more Van Damme fun facts. So the second movie, Kurt McKinney and Van Damme were supposed to be in it. Van Damme actually talked Kurt out of it. And the reasons why blew my mind. So he's talking to Kurt and he's like, hey, we can't go this. Apparently, again, I just read this from the internet, but I'm taking it as fact. He's like, I guess it was filming in Cambodia or on the Cambodian border. And so he tells Kurt, we're going to get robbed. He also says, and then this is in quotes, we're also going to get butt raped. What? That's what Jean-Claude Van Damme, that term, I did not. This is not me riffing. This is what that gentleman says. So again, unbelievable. And that's the thing with Van Damme is like, you know, you want to be like, you know, this guy's, you know, maybe we should, you know, again, future like crystal ball looking into like, maybe we should cancel him. But I just love how unbelievable he is. Like, I just, the things that should make me put off from Van Damme, and this is specific to him, endear me to him. Like, I don't get it.
Oh, yeah.
It's so weird. Okay, this is my, I should tell this to the therapist, not you and Dom, but that's all I have to say.
We're working through it. We're working through it. So, friends, if you have not seen this movie, I hope that our conversation here has encouraged you to see it. Because it's for all the layers of this film, there's a lot of fun in it. If just to see Scott eating an entire cake with his bare hands, please go see it. Jason, do you know where this is streaming right now?
So I watched on the Roku channel. I think it's on Freevee as well. Honestly, another way to watch it, which don't do this the first time you watch it because you want to do it pure, but they have riff tracks of it on Freevee as well. Yes. I believe Mystery Science Theater has covered this movie.
Yes, like, I think
I mean, like, how did I miss this? This is why I get frustrated myself, because it's clearly a cult, you know, oddity. And so, again, that bums me out. In terms of physical media...
Oh, that's where I was going to go next. So you're way ahead of me, man. So, Jay, if our physical media-loving listeners here, what is the definitive edition physical disc of this movie that our listeners should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, so what I find interesting is, again, like, I just assumed I would have had this on... You know, if not DVD, Blu-ray at some point. Unfortunately, no. Like, this was new to Blu-ray, I would say, within the past 10 years. It looks like it came out in 2017, so, like, almost 5 years. But Kino Lorber put out, again, a terrific company. They put out a lot of great oddities, this being one of them. But there's a commentary, which, Mike, it sounds like you listened to, with the screenwriter. They have an interview with Kurt McKinney on there.
Yeah,
it's a really nice disc. And again, like, we saw it on, you know, 35mm and in kind of a scratchy kind of really used print, which had its charms, but seeing it in, you know, HD is also has its own benefits. What I kind of like, there's,
I would say, quote unquote HD, because,
well, it's not perfect, right? Yeah.
There's still a lot of scratchiness in it.
Yeah. The only other thing I wanted to mention is the German title of this, because I was looking at discs from across the world. The German title of this movie is Karate Tiger. I thought that was kind of fun.
Speaking of titles, I know I mentioned this before, but the original title of this was Ring of Truth.
Yes.
And in that commentary on the Kino Lorber disc, Keith said that he changed the name to No Retreat, No Surrender because he loves Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. And he heard, I am a Bruce Springsteen fan, but not a fanatic. So
he has a song like, it's either No Retreat or No Surrender. I forget which one it is, but that's
or
what
something,
he got.
But right, it's in there. Yeah. So he changed it because he's like, I really love the name of that. And I wasn't sure, like, time wise. Did he realize that he put that phrase in the movie like five times, or or he changed the name and then had RJ say it like 5 times.
Yeah.
Yes. No retreat, no surrender. This has been a blast, guys. Any final thoughts on this movie, or are we ready to close, bring this ship home?
Bring it home. Set it
off. Yeah.
All right. Well, to all our listeners, again, thank you for joining us on another Once Upon a Time in the 80s adventure. Make sure you're following us on Twitter or X, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok at Punches and Popcorn. And if you're looking for more 80s action, make sure you give us a follow and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or any of your podcast apps. And be sure to check out the other shows on our Punchador Podcast Network, including the Anomaly Presents Genre Film Podcast, Food About Town with our pal Chris Lindstrom, the Level Up Coffee Podcast, and Behind the Glass, celebrating the amazing photographers blessing Rochester with their art. Until next time, just remember...
Who's the lard ass?
Beat it, Brucey! Go out home and play with your wooden dolly!
Take a walk, fat boy.
You stay out of this or you're gonna get hurt. This is between him and me. Get him!
Alright, no retreat, no surrender.
Good night.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.